The truth.
Welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. It is your Chinese tea house of free speech. So it's where we sit, and you can have oolong cha, or you can have black tea, or all sorts of other teas, green tea, and sip it and think about what's happening to civilization and humanity, because an awful lot is going on. And while you do that, check republicbroadcasting.org, because we badly need fundage. There will be instructions on how best to provide that fundage, because there's no guarantee RBN will keep on the air. There's no guarantee, but we're doing our best, so please help us. And go to nationalbugle.com, download the awesome CoSertified app. Okay, so today, this is our Monday show, recorded on Sunday, and we have Cato with us. Cato, welcome to the show.
Dajiao, thank you for having me back, Dr. Slattery, and yes, while you're all enjoying your Chinese tea, yes, be thinking about civilization, especially the downfall of Western civilization, and how Western civilization is unfortunately not doing very well. It has become, white people have become the new sick men of the world, whereas Eastern civilization is very much alive and well and very much flourishing. So we will be talking about Eastern civilization, of course, China, making up the bulk of it.
Yeah, making up the bulk of it. Then you got place like Japan, which is a kind of, and to, I guess to an extent South Korea, kind of a weird hybrid, where it's where there's been a lot of Western civilization adopted into a fundamentally Eastern culture.
So it's politically Western but culturally still Eastern, because Japan and South Korea are liberal democracies just like the West, and that's why it is politically Western but culturally Eastern. China is Eastern throughout.
Culturally confused. Like, when I went to South Korea, somebody there was making the argument that South Korea is the most Confucian society on Earth. Because if you look at, well, Japan is just much more Western, and the People's Republic of China and North Korea had their Confucianistic characteristics eroded by communism. So that was maybe
at the time, but today
has there been a comeback of Confucianist values over the past 30 or 40 years in China? And then also had they ever really eroded away in Taiwan?
Oh, big time. There's been a huge comeback of Confucian values in China, especially under President Xi Jinping, and then in Taiwan. Yes, you do have a lot of Confucian values in Taiwan too, although the problem is Taiwan, after Chiang Kai-shek's son, Jiang Jingguo, released, you know, after he stepped down, he turned Taiwan from a nationalist, from an authoritarian nationalist state, which, you know, started by his father, into a liberal democracy. So, unfortunately, now Taiwan has become, you could say, politically Western, but still culturally Eastern, even though
the Jiang Dynasty didn't have a Chinese heir to it, because Jiang Jingguo had married a Russian woman.
Yeah, he had mixed race children, half Chinese and half Russian. So, yeah, by authentic Chinese standards, they're not Chinese. You know, nothing against them, but they're not Chinese.
You know, at the same time, the Gandhi family, which had a dynasty in India, that dynasty came to an end basically because Rajiv Gandhi had married an Indian woman. An Italian woman. So,
India's a lot more complicated, way more complicated racially.
Okay, well, so much of today, there's a few things to talk about. We're going to get started on an article from, is this from RT?
Yeah, that's true.
It's about the future of China under President, I guess, could we say President for Life, Xi Jinping?
President for what? Sorry.
President for Life?
Yeah.
Do we call him President for Life? Really President for Life, but term limits have been eliminated. Is that the situation?
Yeah, term limits have been eliminated. Whether he's officially going to be the president for life, we still have yet to see. But term limits have officially been eliminated. And we know the term limits were brought in by Deng Xiaoping, who he basically saw that because Mao was just so old. I mean, he was bad from the beginning, but he was so old at the very end. He basically couldn't do anything. I mean, he was almost like, you know how buffoonish and senile Joe Biden is now, and how he's just falling up and down. Like, Mao was essentially, he couldn't even get off his chair without anyone helping him. So, yeah, basically Deng Xiaoping said, yeah, we have to have term limits, because if the party leader, if the chairman or the general secretary gets too old, and he's not able to lead the nation, so we have to have term limits. That's why he established the term limits.
Jiang Zemin and Hu Yao, not Hu Yaobang.
Hu Jintao.
They both served five-year terms?
Yeah,
three five-year terms, and then stepped aside.
Yeah, of course.
And Xi Jinping is in towards the end of his second five-year term, but he's not going to be term limited out.
Not this time, probably not. Now, that doesn't mean that Xi Jinping will be president for life. Obviously, when he gets old and he knows that he's, let's say, not as strong to lead the nation and lead the party, obviously, I think he will step down and let someone else take over for him. Because part of preserving your legacy is to step down when you're no longer, when you no longer have that sharpness and that strength. Mm-hmm. So that's what defines your legacy.
There was a Muslim and I suppose Arab scholar from the 1300s, I believe. His name was, what was his name? It was Ibn Khaldun. And I guess Ibn just means son of, but Ibn Khaldun. And he had written about senility in dynasties. And this is just something he had observed, that you'd have not talking about actually a single person's lifespan or life cycle, but they're a life cycle of a dynasty, where they take over when they're they're physically robust. It's typically some sort of, might be a violent takeover, and they're physically robust. They come in, and then as as they rule and it goes to the next generation and maybe a generation after that, the ostentatious trappings of authority take greater importance than, you know, martial training. And so you get all this opulent, ostentatious displays of wealth, and the subsequent generations have less martial qualities, and then he describes that as senility, and then the dynasty perishes because another more robust, more virile, more martial group will come in and take over and start a new dynasty. But you saw some of that in Marxist-Leninist leadership. And I'm talking about Marxist-Leninist leadership, it's with the Politburos and central committees and whatnot. And you saw really an ossification of leadership. So in the 1970s, I guess 60s too, you could say that China was under kind of an ossified leadership, with Mao was old, Zhou Enlai was old, and even when Deng Xiaoping took over, he was already old.
And
the Soviet Union in more or less the same time, late 70s, early 80s, just Brezhnev was old and doddering and probably senile. And the same with Chernyenko and Andropov. They were infirm. And now, of course, we have this with Biden. But anyway, I'm kicking it back to you.
Well, the thing, too, is if you look at, you see that photo with Mao sitting next to President Nixon and Henry Kissinger. And you just see how just fragile Mao is and how he's, like, just not all there. Whereas, Nixon, Kissinger are pretty much dictating to Mao, okay, what do you need to do to what do you basically, there was really no, you could clearly tell who was, who was the more dominant of the two, in the diplomatic talks. And it made China, the nation, look really bad on the world stage.
So yeah, Nixon was actually quite young. He was, by the time he got to be president, he wasn't super young, but he wasn't old. He was born in, 1913. I think he was born in 1913. He was a couple of years younger than Ronald Reagan. And so if he was born in 1913, by the time he resigned from office after 5 years, he might have been 61, I guess. So he wasn't that old. He was in his when he was in office, he was in his late 50s. It's not that old. And Kissinger was born, I think, in the late 1920s. So he would have been, mid 40s at the time. He was quite young.
Mm-hmm.
It can mean something. And of course, you look at Biden right now, and Biden is so clearly not with it. And I don't even know who's running the show. Some people. Who do you think's running the show in America?
Well, it's the collective group of Jews that Biden has appointed to his cabinet. In terms of the U.S. federal government, that's who's running the show. It's Jewish power collectively. It cracks me up, and I just shake my head when I hear these normie conservatives go on about, oh, Biden, Biden has so much power. Biden, he's in charge of so much, and he's taking. It's like Biden has. He can't even hold himself up, basically. Mm-hmm. If it weren't for the Jewish power behind him, holding him up, it's like that's the thing with people who just say, oh, it's all Biden. Yeah, Biden's he's awful, but the people behind him, like how many of these conservatives have heard of the cabinet members, and more importantly, looked into what ethnicity, what racial tribal group they're a part of. I mean, if I started to name names like, Tony Blinken, most people most conservatives may or may not know who he is, but, like Ron Klain, for example, the chief of staff, the Jewish chief of staff, how many of these conservatives have heard of him? Probably not a lot.
None of them.
And here's
it's an extremely important position, too, chief of staff.
It's, you know, one of the top positions. I mean, literally the president's right-hand man. And here's, I've come to the conclusion about this when it comes to Jewish power in the presidency. The Jews actually don't want one of their own being the president, because the president, see, he's the scapegoat. He's the fall guy, because everyone will blame the president and say it's the president that did. No, yeah, it's all the president's fault. And meanwhile, the Jews are working behind the scenes and they get away. But it's the blame falls on the president. That's why they wanted this dumb guy, you know, Joe Biden. That's why they wanted him. They didn't want, you know, like a Bloomberg, because for one thing, too, if you have another Jew,
Bernie Sanders, especially, they didn't want Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, they really didn't want Bernie Sanders, because if you have a fellow Jew as the president, number one, it's more obvious. And number two, suddenly the president is no longer subservient to the Jews. He's now on equal footing with them. So that's why they purposely want the president to be a goy, a dumb goy, so that way that they can use him and he'll get blamed. Whereas
not just a goy, but a dumb goy.
Yeah, a dumb goy.
A dumb goy. Well, I mean, they had Bush. Bush was a dumb goy.
Oh, yeah.
And Obama, you know, Obama's not dumb, but I mean, Obama didn't really have any power base himself.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, his administration was just as Jewish establishment as all the other ones. You know. So.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's get into this article then.
Okay. So the title of this article, this is on RT, Leader for Life, What Xi Jinping's Elevation Means for China and the World. And this is by Tom Foudy, who's a British he's a British political commentator on East Asia. That's, you know, he's been around, you know, quite a while on RT, and he has some, you know, he makes some very good points about China and its relations with the West. So I'll just read, you know, a couple paragraphs from the article, and then we'll discuss it. So he starts out. He says, "Now anointed with the same status afforded to Mao and Deng Xiaoping, Xi has the opportunity to usher in a new era that will complete his vision for the rejuvenation of China while dealing with the threat posed by America. The country's ruling Communist Party passed a significant resolution on Thursday, affirming the 68-year-old leader as a key figure in the party's history, elevating
him."
So
he's 68.
Yeah, 68. Okay. So yes, okay. still in his prime for leadership. "As a key figure in the party's history, elevating him to the same historical status as Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping. The document, a summary of the party's history, addresses its key achievements and future directions. It's only the third of its kind since the party was founded 100 years ago. The first was passed by Mao in 1945 and the second by Deng in 1981. This consolidates Xi's legacy, ideology, and policies as a historic epic for the party and the country's direction. Inevitably, the Western media interpret it critically, claiming Xi was centralizing power, building a personality cult, and taking China in the wrong direction at a time of growing geopolitical friction. What does this affirmation of the man really mean? Why is it happening? And how can we better understand these events other than through the caricature of stereotypical villainy, which portrays Xi as someone who is taking the country backwards or as a threat to the world?" See, this is really ironic and just you know, it's so laughable just how uncredible and just how what's the word I'm looking for, just untrustworthy and really lousy the Western mainstream media is. It's like, on one hand, they say, oh, he's going to take China backwards, you know, back into the days of Mao where everything was poor, and at the same time, oh, he's a threat to American power, American hegemony.
So when China was poor under Mao, it really wasn't much of a threat at all.
No, it wasn't a threat to anybody. It was only a threat to itself. Because if you're poor and backward, and there's internal chaos, and the system at the time under Mao was against their own people, whether it was intentional or not is you know, another story. But it was actively against its own people. So yeah, a system that's against its own people, you know, with the exception of the American Empire, but generally speaking, is not going to be a threat to the entire world.
Okay. Well, so you mentioned the American Empire. We're up at the break, but let's talk about that when we come back.
Come
Hey gang, Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and a new app, Koshertify, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anyone who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future.
Extendivite has proven time and again it really works. Here's a testimonial from Amazon.com. I am only 40, but I have put my body through hell working in manufacturing for 20 years. I recently started to notice a buzzing feeling along with a stuttering sensation with my heart. I had a full cardio stress done, which I passed. I decided to try Extendivite after getting the jingle stuck in my head. Halfway through the bottle, I really did notice a difference. After getting home from work, I would just sit in a chair for a few hours feeling like crap, and this stuff reduced that feeling along with heart discomfort to almost nothing. Extendivite is only $69.95 for a two-month supply. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com. That's HEARTDROP.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. While we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country, here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store. Or call us.
800-724-2719, extension 3. 800-724-2719, extension 3.
Welcome back to the show. So we're in the middle of this article, but just before the break, you said that a government or a regime that's at war with its own people is less likely to be a threat to others. But the thing is, right now in the United States is at war with its own people. And because the United States is or has been the world hegemon for the past 30 years since the demise of the Soviet Union, and because of its massive nuclear weaponry, because of its worldwide archipelago of military bases, it is a threat. And an America that's in the middle of falling apart. I mean, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, when it was falling apart, it was a little bit unnerving. Although internationally, it all's well. It went pretty well. But United States, do you think that the United States might actually break up, that like within the next 5 years or during this decade, that that map makers are going to have to redraw the map because the territorial integrity of the United States, or even the continuity of the state entity known as the United States, that will be no longer?
Well, all I can say is I hope so. That would be great for both the world and for the, not just the European people and, the ethnic European American peoples, but Americans in general. because, you know, the American Empire, I said that you know, regimes are at war with its own people. I mean, obviously, that's not the only factor that determines whether they're a threat to the world. Obviously, you know, size and you know, military power, you know, that matters a lot. But regimes that are internally unstable, which, you know, usually, unless it's from an external force that's causing that internal instability, but regimes that cause themselves to be internally unstable by going at war against their own people, they're generally not a threat to the world, except for the United States. America's, you know, people, oh, American exceptionalism. Yeah, America is exceptional in this regard, that it's, you know, it's exceptionally bad for one, but also it's exceptional in that it's, you know, it's not like any empire you've seen before, to where, you know, there was some kind of structure, some kind of hierarchy, some kind of, you know, base culture and basic nation. Like, you know, we saw with the previous British Empire, as bad as that thing turned into, it still had that British base. Whereas, you know, I've said before, the American Empire is just a blob. It's just a blob, like in the 1950s Steve McQueen movie, The Blob. It just keeps on expanding and has no form and just keeps getting bigger as it consumes more. Well, that's what it is. That's what the American Empire is. It's the first, you could say, cosmopolitan empire, because most empires do turn cosmopolitan after a while, but America started out as one that was cosmopolitan. It was all, you know, big business and Wall Street and the big capitalists that were, you know, fueling the American Empire.
So a few years ago, when Stormfront was a call-in show, I guess it was a call-in show until about a year ago, we would get callers who would call in and talk about the balkanization of the United States and forging some sort of white homeland out of after the balkanization. And balkanization was something that that Don Black would also favor. And I always warned, you know, people to be careful what they wish for, because if you had a some southern states or some Rocky Mountain states that somehow managed to break off from the main United States, you would get the rump United States would maintain control over the bulk of the military assets. And so you'd wind up, potential of whatever breakaway white enclave you had to be completely gazified by the rump United States. Now, the thing is, if you look at certain polling data, what you're finding now, if you can, to the extent you can trust the polling data, is not only are, Texas white Republicans talking about breaking up the United States, but you've got like Northeastern liberals that people are giving up on the idea of the United States, and more people, at least, I think it's premature and maybe a bit reckless, but you know, the trends can move pretty quickly. Just wide swaths of the United of Americans who are giving up on the idea of the United States of America and entertaining the possibility of something different to come. So what do you think there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's wonderful. I think that's great that, you know, people within America are recognizing that America is just way too heterogeneous, way too different internally to stay together, and that different regions have different interests, and that those interests are never going to reconcile with each other. And it's this evil entity, this blob known as the American Empire, that's trying to hold it all together. But that's becoming less and less of a reality, because as more people give up on the, you know, you could say the idea of America, you know, the less amount of influence and power they'll have. You know, of course, they're going to do everything they can, I'm sure, militarily and so forth, to try to, you know, keep the whole thing together. I don't think the American Empire is going to go down just like the Soviet Union. I think they're going to try to hold on to every last breath, which is why it's so dangerous. Because, you know, just like I think a few shows ago, I played a clip by Peter Kuznick, the professor of nuclear studies in, I think, somewhere in Washington, D.C., but he said that we've never seen an empire fall with the nuclear capability to take down the whole world with it.
Well, unless you want to count the Soviet Union. But at any rate, we're up at the break. We'll be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Have you been looking for a trusted long-term storable food company? We have a solution for you. Simply Clean Foods is dedicated to providing the best quality food you can buy next to fresh from a farmer's market. Our line of resealable fruits, vegetables, and meats are suitable for everyday use, and you won't have to worry about throwing away valuable groceries ever again. Our food is completely GMO-free, and our stringent quality controls, plus testing for heavy metals, makes us unique in the storable foods market. Simply Clean Foods' primary focus is to bring clean food to people all around the world and change the way we look at freeze-dried food in our daily cooking. When you purchase from simplycleanfoods.net, not only will you be receiving high-quality food, but you will also be supporting veterans in need across the country and those who are affected by natural disasters. Right now, Amazon Prime members will receive fast 2-day shipping. Go to simplycleanfoods.net. That's simplycleanfoods.net. But do it today.
Are you sick of censorship? TLB Talk is the cure. TLB stands for Truth, Liberty, and Balance. We are the newest and most unique social media platform to hit the internet. We were built out of necessity because Big Tech, Big Pharma, and Big Brother are out of control. The only thing bigger than them is when we, the people, are united. With that vision, TLB Talk was born. Our battlefield is in cyberspace. The battle we're in can be won by clicks of buttons and voting with your wallet. TLB Talk has no hidden agendas, no corporate funding, and we do not sell, trade, or give away any of your information. Our platform runs off of generous donations of members and merchandise profits. So please, check out our site. It's the best around. And be sure to stop by our store. It's loaded with items that'll have you feeling a sense of member pride and victory. Come unite with us today at tlbtalk.com and join the social media revolution.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2 keep it today.
And we are back. Right before the break, I said, with the exception of the Soviet Union, was it an empire? It did have massive nuclear capabilities when it broke up. What do you think?
It did, but it was a lot more rational and a lot more, it was a lot more diplomatic than the American Empire. I mean, the U.S. just wants to wage war against, you know, everyone that stands in its way, that defies its hegemony. Whereas the Soviet Union, I mean, the 1970s and 80s, you know, there was talk about, you know, mutually assured destruction, that, oh, no, we cannot use nukes because we'll mutually assure each other's destruction. But now, and also because the Soviet Union and the United States, the American Empire, both had nukes. So the Soviet Union, if they used them, the Americans would use them, too. And nobody would win at the end. So therefore, the Soviets were a lot more rational. But now the Soviet Union's gone. All that's left is the American Empire. And basically, and here's the thing, like, nobody trusts America with nukes. You know, people, they don't mind Russia or China or even the old Soviet Union having nukes at the time. They don't mind other countries. It's the United States that they don't trust having nukes, because the United States is by far the most likely one to use them. You know, because you look at history, which entity has been the only entity in history to use nukes, you know, precursors of the nukes, you know, the atomic bombs, was the United States on Japan. So that's why nobody United States, because they're the American Empire is reckless. They're absolutely reckless compared to these, you know, other, you could call them empires, you know, the Soviet Union. I mean, yeah, I would say it would fit under that definition. So, you know, that's what,
one other thing is, you know, go ahead and finish.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay, so one other thing with the Soviet Union, perhaps the world was just very, very fortunate that the Soviet Union had Mikhail Gorbachev at the helm when it was breaking up. Of course, there had been one effort to overthrow him. There was a putsch, what they called a putsch, attempted coup by his vice president and others, Vice President Yanayev, because they didn't like the direction things were going in 1991. But and then there was kind of a counter coup led by Yeltsin. And you could have had a civil war between pro-Soviet Gorbachev loyalists and pro-Yeltsin, you know, Russian nationalists or breakaway people. And that could have happened. And maybe that would have happened had the Yanayev coup been successful. But Gorbachev seemed to see, maybe he saw the writing on the wall, maybe he just didn't think it was worth fighting for. Gorbachev went to the Soviet parliament and demanded that they vote themselves out of existence. I mean, he just conceded defeat. He didn't have to, but he did. Okay, so how about this article? What's China going to be like under Xi Jinping for the next decade or two? Might be asking for it, but at least if he's 68 now, you'd think maybe he's got at least another decade, right?
Yes. Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, let me see. Where did I leave off? Okay, here we go. So he continues basically saying, okay, what would it be? So he says, in the century of his existence, the CPC has shown itself to be an adaptive institution which has used pragmatism to respond to various crises, catastrophes, and for that matter, its own mistakes. It has also employed resilience to succeed against the odds, constantly reevaluating itself. From the Long March, when its members retreated thousands of miles to escape persecution, to fighting guerrilla warfare against the Japanese, to conquering all of China and building a revolutionary state through both successes and failures, the party has utilized this accumulated wisdom and experience to adapt and sustain power in a constantly changing world. Its mission has been to reestablish China as a modern, sovereign, and powerful nation, reversing its century of humiliation. Xi Jinping is a living example of such constant reevaluation, or the scientific method that the party utilizes, not just through what he does, but how he links together this whole history. He is, after all, the first leader of the country who has spent all his life under nothing but the People's Republic of China, seeing it all from the beginning to the present day. His childhood was the Mao era, when his dad was a senior party official who was later purged and imprisoned and witnessed the firsthand turmoil of the Cultural Revolution. At 15, Xi was sent to the countryside for re-education and then hard labor for 7 years, an experience that has figured large in his official story.
Why?
Huh?
Why was he sent at 15 to the countryside for re-education and hard labor?
Well, because he was not Maoist enough. He was considered, his father was probably considered part of the, you know, a rightist by Mao. So, and Mao obviously was far left, so he was sent to the countryside because he was not Maoist enough. But it continues, far from rebelling against the party, Xi embraced it. He tried to join it several times, and when he was finally accepted in 1974, he worked hard to rise up the ranks, a journey that resulted in him being picked as president in 2012. Now facing off against the U.S., Xi is leading China into an era of his own, pitting together the fluidity of the party's existence. And it is this shifting situation today, as well as his own interest in socialist theory, that are defining his tenure. Before him, it was widely assumed the party was on an inevitable trajectory of reform and liberalization, which would eventually change China to mirror the West. The so-called end of history, you know, that Fukuyama, the liberal New World Order.
Right.
Yeah. Which placed, faith in liberalism's inevitable and logical victory. It is no surprise that in Western eyes, Xi is erroneously depicted as the man who is taking the country backwards. But that doesn't help us understand what he is doing or why he's doing it. China has changed because its place in the world has changed and has what the party perceives as necessary for its national progress. The hopes and optimism of the Deng Xiaoping era never took notice of the reality that in the 1980s, China was a weak and poor country contingent upon Western goodwill for its progress and development in moving past the mistakes of the Mao era. Not because it was on a path to one day dismantling communism, as liberals assumed, or had already disregarded it in all but name, and not because its goals were different. A phrase commonly associated with the Deng period was that China was keeping a low profile, and in many respects it was. But what Xi now sets out in the future is a testament to the reality that such a world no longer exists and is no longer suitable for what China needs. It is impossible for it to keep a low profile today. The country has grown to become the world's second largest economy and is at a critical economic juncture whereby it must take the leap from becoming a per capita middle income country towards being a high one. In line with that, it faces considerable challenges from a U.S., finally awakened from the fantasy that Beijing was going to morph into its own image, meaning liberal, but it no longer tolerates a rising China. Such new realities required a structural overhaul of how China is governed. The China of the past may have coincided with and complemented with U.S. interests, both economic and strategic, but no longer is that the case. The West believed it always knew what was good for China, but the time has come whereby what is in China's interest may conflict with the West's agenda. As a result, this new era of Xi Jinping is not as much about the man himself as it is about these new circumstances and needs. Even if he is at the center of it. With the more loose and open approach of the previous administrations under Deng Xiaoping, Jiang Zemin, and Hu Jintao have been suitable for these new challenges? Where the party role is downplayed and where businesses hold enormous sway? Could that system deal with the attempts by the U.S. to block China's rise in strategic technologies or assert its national sovereignty across several areas? Administrations that ignored wealth inequality and pretended China was a socialist country in name only? It is only natural that in an environment of growing insecurity and uncertainty with more specific and tailored goals, the state pragmatically adapted to reassert itself. Americans like to frequently blame Xi for the declining relations between the two countries, but it is foolish to think the U.S. could have accepted a rising communist China under any circumstance, or that goodwill from Beijing could have kept them at bay. These reasons are why Xi has been more than willing to take considered risks preemptively, such as responding to America's military encirclement by advancing China's claims in the South China Sea to build the Belt and Road to offset the economic vulnerabilities, or to bring the hammer down on Hong Kong and other regions before they become liabilities. They may have all served to exacerbate the emerging Cold War, yet they were one step ahead of what Xi perceived was inevitably coming. The increasing U.S. moves to contain and suppress China, which are here now. The China of was not prepared to meet that challenge. It is now. Yet there is more to it. Xi's decisions mirror the reality that China can no longer go with development for the sake of development or growth for the sake of growth, because the consequences of its boom create problems and side effects which will not go away on their own. We see, for example, how the Evergrande situation, while not the spectacular disaster the Western media may have made it out to be, nonetheless represents a big shift away from real estate and debt-binging growth. The live-and-let-be capitalism of the West is not the solution for China, and quite frankly, it sucks here in the West, too, having this you know, live-and-let-be free market capitalism.
Laissez-faire. Yeah, live-and-let-do, I guess. Yes, let-do. Laissez-faire actually just means let-do. Let them do. Let it do. It's French.
That's done so much damage to white families and, you know, just people in the West in general, Americans especially.
Yeah. There's a brief comment I want to make. You know, earlier in the article, there was something about – there was a reference to the CCP as being pragmatic. And, you know, a lot of people – because, you know, most people – don't know a whole lot about China, and you know, maybe why would they? They will tend to equate Mao with the CCP, and I don't think you really can. And I think if you look at Mao's tenure in office, he had massive challenges from the CCP, and after the failure of the Great Leap Forward, he had a fair amount of his he had his wings clipped. I mean, he wasn't exactly overthrown, but he had to give up some of his power, share some of his power, I guess you'd say, and the Cultural Revolution was an effort to get some of it back. But I think maybe I'm wrong, and I'm not that much of an expert, but I think the CCP was at times, especially during Mao's worst excesses, the CCP was more pragmatic and was a counterbalance to him. And a lot of the politics of China wasn't driven by the CCP. It was driven by Mao personally. Mao and, you know, his what was his youth brigade called? The Red Guard? Is that what it was called?
Yeah, the Red Guards.
Yeah. And the CCP was a counterbalance to it a lot of the time. The CCP is not just a rubber stamp institution of Mao. Maybe at some points Mao could kind of overpower it, but certainly not all the time. And in the end, Mao was not able to put his hand-selected successor Hua Guofeng into office for, you know, a long period of time. Nor was his wife able to take over. You had I don't know what you would call him. I mean, Deng Xiaoping was somebody who had at least been for a while in exile during Mao's rule. So, I don't know. Those are my impressions.
Well, it's like this. You know, you have your traditional Venn diagram. You know, the two Venn diagrams with the two circles, and then they overlap. And one, you can have one circle that says, you know, Mao, you know, Maoists, and the other circle says CCP, and then in the middle there's both, and then. You know, you can write down all the stuff that was exclusively Mao, all the stuff that was exclusively CCP, and then there's, you know, some things that were done by both. Mm. But yeah, it was Mao and the CCP. Mao is only the only reason why they still have Mao's symbol is because it's just a symbol. That's it. It's just a symbol for the founding of the People's Republic of China. But you know, Mao in many ways, he damaged the CCP in many ways. And there was one instance too, just an example of how the two contrasted during the Cultural Revolution, when the Red Guards were smashing everything and destroying everything. You actually had Zhou Enlai, who was the premier under Mao, send in the People's Liberation Army to protect some of those ancient sites from getting destroyed by the Red Guards.
Right. Yeah, and he had protected like the giant palace in Lhasa, Tibet, for instance. I visited there, and I remember the tour guide mentioning that. It had been protected by Zhou Enlai. So you had the people's called the People's Liberation Army, and they're not necessarily fighting, not necessarily in combat with the Red Guard, but maybe in kind of a standoff.
Yeah, just kind of like holding their position and pushing them back, not allowing them to advance.
Okay, and is there more to the article?
Yeah, I'm going to look through it, see if there's the key points. There's still quite a bit more. There's like several paragraphs left. But I think I'll just bring up the key paragraphs, and then we'll just discuss those.
Yeah, we got another couple of minutes in this segment.
Yeah, okay. Oh, in that case, then I can just keep reading then. And then whatever I don't read, I'll finish at the end of the break, or I'll finish on the next segment.
Okay.
So it continues. Yeah, obviously the capital, live and let be, the laissez-faire capitalism of the West is not the solution for China. And, you know, I said it's not, it's destroyed the West completely. So, you know, he says, one wonders what would have happened if the Evergrande situation were allowed to continue in the fashion it has. China's clampdowns on big tech also look at the longer term, bigger picture. It is easy to write everything off as a mere act of control or dominance concerning the party. But it requires real critical thinking to recognize what is driving these changes and why the Xi era is challenging China's direction for a new epoch. We should understand China's own interpretation of its party history like this. And here it goes. Mao established a revolutionary state, albeit one that did not function well bureaucratically or economically. Deng then took that legacy and refined it, creating a state which functioned and thrived under the process of reform and opening up, utilizing geopolitical realism to court the West. Now, Xi Jinping, with a modern China facing resistance from the West as an emerging power, is reasserting the authority and leadership of the party to adapt the country not only for its growth needs, but to continue moving forward in what he describes as the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. Xi Jinping, he's very nationalist. The party has always acted to ensure its survival, but that survival is inseparably tailored to the successes of the broader goal of the revival of China. To reduce the CPC to a clique of small, evil little group of men obsessed with power and on a mission of global conspiracy is both ignorant, unhelpful, and completely off the mark. China has, whether you agree with it or not, moved into a new phase of its history in response to its new needs and circumstances. In doing so, C has cemented himself as ruler for life and placed himself on the same level as Mal. That is a statement not only of his personal vision, but also of historical significance. He is aiming to change and shape China permanently in a revolutionary manner. The stakes here are immense. Will China go on to be the world's largest economy? Will it reunify with Taiwan? Will it see off the challenge posed by the U.S., hopefully, for their sake and for the sake of the American people also? But this is how history will ultimately define and judge him, is by what he does, not by the... Yeah.
All right. Well, we are up on the last break. We'll be right back. Hey gang, Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and the new app, Koshertified, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anyone who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, no child left behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing. Knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives?
I have another update on the fundraising situation. We can accept PayPal through the RBN site. You can mail in cash or a money order with the pay to line left blank. The postal address is 2251 Double Creek Drive, number 302, Round Rock, Texas, 78664. Nothing made out to RBN will work, so don't do that. The new accounts are going to be opened soon, and if you have any questions, call 800-724-2719, extension 3. Feel free to call on in on this issue, and we'll try and get you squared away. The network thanks you.
We are back. All right. So I mean, my number one hope would be that the American people manage to wake up to the reality of Jewish power. And if they wake up to the reality of Jewish power can simply just dissolve. It can just melt away because Jewish power is, it has to be stealth. It has to be stealth because, and, you know, as Gilad Osman said, the essence of Jewish power is the ability to stifle the discussion of Jewish power. But I think the corollary to that is once Jewish power is discussed, it melts away. And that's not a violent thing. That's just, it just melts away. That's what I would like. I don't know if that's, it sounds simple. It sounds simple enough. I don't know if it can happen. Maybe it can, maybe it can't. I guess the next best scenario would be a breakup of the United States into smaller non-superpower entities like you see in Europe, and a global system that would be maybe dominated by China and Russia, and hopefully wouldn't be imperial. What do you think?
Well, yeah, well, China and Russia, they've already said we're not going to invade any other nations. We're not going to do what the United States is doing by you know, colonizing the whole world. We want multilateralism. We want, this is what the Belt and Road Initiative is about, lifting up all nations out of poverty and all nations developing equally. You know, maybe not on equal paths, but, you know, all having the chance to develop. Yeah, Russia and China, they want a multipolar world. A world where all nations, there are no, because Xi Jinping, he said in his speech, there are no superior nations. There are no superior or inferior nations. Actually, it was the foreign minister Wang Yi, who's by the way, he's really based, Wang Yi, and he said that there are no such thing as superior nations. And I'm paraphrasing here. There are no such thing as superior nations. If the United States cannot learn that there are no such thing as superior nations, and the United States keeps wanting to bully the world, the whole world needs to come together and teach the United States a lesson. That's what he said. And yeah, and you know, regarding Jewish power, I'll say this too. I mean, to I guess put it into, you know, what Gilad Osman said about you know, not being able to talk about Jewish power is proof of Jewish power, is also, I mean, making this, you know, this fact, this reality that's so simple to understand, seems so complicated and so out there that only the, you know, the you know, according to the Jewish media, the worst kooks, that only kooks believe in. But it's so simple to understand. I mean, Jewish power is in your face. It's not even so secretive. I mean, you just look at who's in charge of the federal government, all of Biden's cabinet positions, and, you know, all the media bosses and you know, Wall Street. It is so obvious. But they make it so complicated, and it's so, you know, crazy. Like, they make it sound
It is so obvious. I mean, it's a house of cards, and really could come crashing down, because how long would it take somebody who has, like, some sort of a little bit of discernment to be able to understand that Biden's top government officials, his cabinet, his you know, the Ron Klain, that the heads of the media, that the heads of the social media, so many important positions, the heads of the major universities are overwhelmingly Jewish. Once somebody realizes that, then how can they not talk about Jewish power?
Exactly. Then it's so simple, yet to most normies, it's so complicated. Because the Jews have purposely made it that way, which that right there is the proof of Jewish power. Taking something simple and making it so complicated and controversial.
Convoluted. And always pointing the figure somewhere else, whether it's, you know, it's globalists or Masons or Jesuits or the Chinese. But we're up at the end of the show, but thank you so much for joining me, Cato.
Well, thank you, Dr. Flattery. Look forward to next week. Zaijian.
Zaijian. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.
Chinatown, my Chinatown, where the lights are low.
Standing 6'4", weighing in 245 pounds of crime-fighting, political science-analyzing brawn, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Patrick Slattery.
So, Mike, get off this anti-cicada agenda.
I'm a born-again traditional Christian. And my favorite possessions are right here on my nightstand. That would be the King James Bible and my .357 revolver.
I'd rather be ruled by Chinamen than Jews.
Cool it with the anti-Semitic remarks, right?
Just because you steal an election and terminate the republic doesn't mean you terminate the people in the republic, because we're still here.
I'm not taking the vaccine. F*** you, Bill Gates.
There was a way forward still on January 6th. What needed to be done is to object to every single state.
The COVID-19 virus was the setup. The vaccine could very well be the bioweapon.
The Patrick and Jeremy Show, Tuesday at 9 Central and Wednesday at 1 Central. This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.